Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about Kenpo and the martial arts and whatever else we want to chit-chat about. I am Reggie Darden, and today I have with me Alex Ellis, and we're just going to jump in and talk about Kenpo and kind of go from there. So just to kind of, you know, give my little background, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording here, but just kind of my background. I've always been a big fan of the martial arts and watching the Kung Fu movies, Black Belt Theater and Kung Fu Theater back in the day, and just always wanted to be a part of the martial arts, and didn't actually get to formally start training until the early mid-90s after I saw a little film called The Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman. You know, I don't think any of the listeners have heard of it, but you know, you can Google it. But so I saw that movie, and me and my best friend said, you know, hey, we got to do this Kenpo thing. So I actually didn't get to start. My friend started at the school that we found. And I actually didn't get to start till maybe about 6 months to a year after he did. But you know, I was at the school every day from opening till close, just, you know, watching the classes and getting what little secret squirrel stuff my friend would show me, and just kind of absorbed as much as I could. And I finally, you know, got my chance to sign up and slap on the old uniform and get in there. I, you know, trained for about 2-3 years. Got about halfway through my green belt towards my third brown, and I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to do some Taekwondo and some Hapkido and some boxing while I was in the service. Once I got out of the military, I wanted to keep training, but I just couldn't find a school that I liked. I didn't really want to get back into Taekwondo or anything like that, and I just didn't find a Kenpo school at the time. So I just kind of, you know, did my own thing, just kind of you know, trained with what I could remember from my earlier days, and just kind of, you know, piddled around with you know, anybody that I kind of came across with, and just kind of worked on little things here and there. And then I got involved in Capoeira, and much like Kenpo, was just instantly in love, and had to do that and train that. And so as of this recording, I'm coming up on 17 years doing Capoeira. And just loving that, and hanging in there as much as my body will allow. About 2 or 3 years ago, the Kenpo bug re-entered my life. I refound my old training manual and decided I was going to try and work my way through to see what I could remember, you know, forms and techniques and whatnot, and it just really relit that fire for Kenpo. And I just knew that I just had to get back into it. So I started finding, you know, looking for a school, and I found an American Kenpo school here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that, you know, I enjoyed the way my instructor taught. So I said, yeah, I'm going to sign up and get back into that. And so... yeah, I've been training at this school for the last 2 or 3 years. I'm about, I guess it's been about 2 months in since getting my green belt. So I'm pretty stoked about that, and just enjoying the training. The brown belt stuff is fun. And then also at this point, I am now officially in the instructors program at my school. So I'm excited about that. When I was at my first school, I was going to get involved in the instructor program, but just didn't get that opportunity since I knew I was leaving for the military. So, you know, I passed on signing up for that. But now that I get to I taught my first class I guess a couple of weeks ago, and then actually taught one of our new guys last night, so I'm pretty feeling pretty good about that. And then in my Capoeira days, I actually took over our school and took over our group, or inherited our group. And so I was actually kind of teaching, Capoeira for quite a few years, and trying to kind of get that going a little bit now. But with life and work and now a podcast, it's there's not enough time in the day for everything. But I'm just enjoying what I can, and enjoying the Kenpo journey, and then also keep my eyes on a lot of other things. There's a lot of other arts out here that I'd like to get involved with, so we'll kind of see how that journey goes. But yeah, that's kind of the rundown of my background. So Mr. Ellis, if you could go ahead and fill us in on how did Kenpo find you? How did you get started? Kind of your lineage, and we'll just kind of go from there.
I am Sifu Alex Ellis. I just recently got my black belt about a year ago now, for my first degree. And shortly after getting my black belt, unfortunately, I had to take a break for my own medical health. I'm a rare case in Kenpo, but one that's kind of growing nowadays. I grew up in it. So I started training technically when I was 3, but was really put into a training class when I was 4. So I grew up with the same school for about 18 years now, until recently. So my lineage is a bit up in air currently, thanks to a little bit of controversy that happened with me splitting with my teacher. So my lineage, as far as I'm concerned, goes from my from me to my father to his teacher, which was a multitude of teachers. My father had trained with Fumio Demura when he was young. May he rest in peace.
Oh, very God, nice.
A legendary man.
Oh, yeah.
And then when he was down in Florida, he had trained with a Chinese practitioner out there. And then a Capoeira guy who I wish I knew the name. I can't remember the name for the life of me of the Capoeira guy. But Capoeira is a hell of an art, not going to lie. But then he came out here to Vegas, where I'm from, and I don't know if Jeff was active at the time in Vegas or not. I don't know like what was going on there, but Dad found a school at the time and pretty much stuck with it until we left recently. So it was really interesting. He was running the school for the last about 5 years is when we moved and got a new location, and then everything shit happens. But my lineage goes from before that to Paul Mills is who we believe my ex-teacher's teacher was, and that is what we've been able to back up with story. Unfortunately, I can't ask the man himself now because he's unfortunately passed away, but I also do have other teachers that I've learned from over the years, a praying mantis instructor, a Pylon Dao instructor from Florida, Grandmaster Wilson, a few Kaja Kenpo instructor, a few Jiu-Jitsu instructors. So I have a decent understanding of a good amount of arts. I have about, not a black belt level understanding of most, but I will say I have about a competent blue to green belt level understanding of most of the arts I've trained in.
Okay, right on. Now, so, since you've been doing this since you were young, was it kind of a situation where, you were forced to do it, or at one point, or, were you always interested in it? Or was there a point where you're like, even though I'm being thrust into this, you know, now that I have, you know, the ability to make my own decisions, you know, what kept you into it?
So that's the fun part, is I've had my moments where I really wanted to quit over the years. Either because of how my ex-teacher was just as a person, or due to life events that were going on. And when you're a teenager, a lot's going on. You don't really want to give up your youth for, you know, a longevous art, because it doesn't really matter to you at the time, to be honest. And what kept me in the love for it was the art itself, and the fact that I was good at something. And it was kind of being able to develop that skill and that training over time that really helped. But the reason I stayed in was because of one of the fights I got into when I was about 14. I didn't really take much seriously at that point. Like, I trained, but I didn't train, like, diligently until it mattered. And then when it mattered, I realized, oh, huh, this actually works. Weird. Okay, well, I might as well go train harder. And that was at the time where I was already a multi-time world champion in the Southwest divisions. So I trained harder and then kept winning, and it just kept going from there. So, like, I've had my moments, but the love of the art and some of the people I've gotten to meet and train with, and some of the grandmasters I've gotten to work with over the years, really is what kept me in the love for it and kept me in it.
Very nice. Now, so, you know, Kenpo has been your primary system.
Kenpo's been my primary system for about the entire time I've been training, where I've had offshoots into some Chinese martial arts, where we'll learn from different styles and then add it to what we've learned.
Hmm. Okay. And, you know, what would make, you know, Kenpo your primary? What aspects of it, I guess, you know, would make you want to choose that as your primary? Or
Kenpo as it is a really interesting art when you get down to the nitty-gritty, because it's one of the easier to understand striking arts. Like, it is, when done well, sorry, give me a moment. When done well, it is a easy art to understand if you have a good teacher, and an amazing art when you have somebody that can not only show you what you're not doing just right, but really help you feel what's going on. So, like, five swords being a staple technique, you know, timing, pop, 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 pop. It's kind of having somebody that understands, okay, how is the body going to react from each of these hits, so that you can just keep feeding into every strike. And that's the reason that it's my bread and butter, is because it's the main art I trained in, sure, but it's the one I have the most competent understanding of, even at a first degree black belt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so since you have this, you know, experience with these other arts, you know, I've always been a fan of Kenpo, because it works as a good base for connecting with other arts. So my original school, you know, we had, you know, kind of some Taekwondo, you know, the kicking part of it. You know, we were much more kickers than Kenpo schools are typically known for. Because I thought, you know, that it just fits really well. And, you know, I brought this up with some of my other guests, but you know, I used to watch the Panther production videos back in the day, and there was a video with David German, and he was doing he was mixing jiu-jitsu. It was like the Kenpo jiu-jitsu connection, and he was mixing in jiu-jitsu with the Kenpo, and, you know, I was just loving it. And, you know, one that really stood out was, you know, he's adding these wrist locks and these arm locks into Flashing Wings, and I was like, you know, this is so cool. It just works so perfectly. It just fits right in. And so I've just always really, really liked that. So with your you know, experience with other arts, you know, do you see those connections, or has the, you know, Kenpo helped you out with the other arts, and or the other arts helped with your Kenpo? Has there been any kind of cross-pollination with that?
So Kenpo is a good base art. It is a really, really good base art for taking the concepts and principles and applying it to other arts. As it happens, we've done some similar stuff with that when I was training, to where some of our grandmasters would show us where that connection was so that we could get that knowledge and go, oh, huh, you can add that there and it works beautifully. Neat. So, like, arm bars and such, we didn't quite go for that. More so how we could make some of our breaks and tears more effective. So a good example of this is when you're catching somebody to get their arm behind their back, right? I can't remember the name of the lock at the moment. It's gonna escape me. But one of the things that we learned from my jiu-jitsu instructor was that instead of just, you know, doing it nice and gently, there's a much meaner way to do it that's more efficient, where instead of letting the front arm go up, you just pull the arm out of socket. They'll be very compliant with you when the arm's pulled out of socket.
Yeah, I think that would work and get their attention.
Just a little, you'd hope at least. But so cross-pollination is something that I thankfully was able to get. It was really nice that I had instructors that were able to see it and teach it so that we weren't just looking at it, oh, this is a separate art. It's like, well, no, martial arts is really kind of ice cream if you really think about it. It's a bunch of flavors of essentially the same thing, because humans can only physiologically move so many different ways. Just different methods of thinking about it, which is one of the beauties of a lot of martial arts. A lot of Kenpo guys may not like this, but Kenpo is really one of the original mixed martial arts.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And I see a lot of the DNA of a lot of, you know, other martial arts influences in Kenpo. You know, one of the things, you know, with MMA and the UFC, and everybody's talking about jiu-jitsu and whatnot. And, you know, Kenpo, if you look at, you know, a lot of the techniques, there are a lot of techniques that, you know, are inspired or deal with, you know, a lot of holds and grabs and locks. And there is a lot of, you know, kind of the jiu-jitsu, judo, you know, grappling. There is a lot of grappling in Kenpo. And I don't think that gets maybe shown or highlighted as much as, you know, I think people you would expect in you know, MMA environment now that we have, where, you know, everybody's talking about, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and you know, similar systems. But yeah, you know, Kenpo has a lot, you know, no art has everything in my view, but nope. Kenpo has a lot more than I think really gets shown or highlighted, and it is effective in a lot of the different ranges and whatnot. So,
a lot of Kenpo can be summed up to hiding motion in motion and hiding strikes in motion, and it's a really beautiful thing. Like if we go back to flashing wings, block here, elbow strike here before pulling out, hit, where like that flow here is four different strikes that some newcomers to the technique may not see. There, you could also realistically turn that into a reaping throw. You can turn that into, you know, flipping somebody over on their back. Like there's a lot of different ways you can take the base techniques, which is like one of the reasons I really did start falling in love with Kenpo when I was younger, is like, it was really cool to be able to go, oh, I can modulate this. I don't have to do this like to the T. It's good to learn it so that I understand what the base concept is here. But if this is what the technique's teaching, let's really delve into it.
Exactly. I like that. So jumping over to the competition. So you've done a lot of competing. My side of it, I went to a lot of tournaments, but as far as the ones I actually competed in, we could, count on one hand. And I enjoyed it, but I guess I didn't really enjoy it because I kept getting disqualified. So,
excessive force.
Well, a lot of it was, I go for the good old, back knuckle, reverse punch. And it's like, you're not allowed to hit him in the head or it's too hard. Or like, really? Like, they're still excessive standing. Excessive force. So.
Because if you do this and their head rocks back, it's excessive force.
Yeah, so
I'm sorry you couldn't get a boxing license to be able to have an actual competition. That's not my problem.
Yeah. I that always bothered me. You know, we're covered in sparring gear, and we're doing controlled hits, and it's like, the guy's still standing. So yeah, it wasn't excessive, because if it was excessive, he would be unconscious. So
he's still standing, he's not bleeding, what's the problem? Says it's fine.
Which that's kind of carried over into class now for me. And we're doing our technique lines or whatever, and you we're doing a technique, and you get that little shot, and your partner's like, oh my god, and I'm like, look, unless I'm screaming, we're okay. Yeah, you might have, caught my chin a little bit with that shot, or, hit my groin or whatever. I got my cup on, so we're good.
Training happens, and that's why you take precautions. Exactly. It's training. Exactly.
It's I always have a laugh from just the look on someone's face. I'm not screaming, so we're fine. Unless I'm screaming or unconscious, let's keep going. So.
Even when I'm unconscious, continue the technique so you do it right. Like, come on.
Exactly. But the competition, I only did the sparring. I didn't get to do the forms. I wanted to do, forms and weapons, but at the time I was not advanced rank enough yet to do the forms that I wanted to do. So the school that I started at, we had the form known as book set or Panther set.
Book set.
And I wanted to do that form in a tournament in Tiger and Crane, but I didn't have those yet. Or by the time I got book set, I wasn't really interested in doing any tournament. So I may still, in my advanced age, I have a little bit of desire to do a form in a tournament, but I don't know. We'll see if that happens. But
advanced age, you look young. You've got to be like 30 something.
I wish. I got some shoes that are that young. But can you talk about? Talk about your, the tournament life and how your tournament career went.
So my career started way back when I was about 10. Earlier. I was 9 for my first tournament, as it would happen. I didn't win my first time. I didn't win my second time either, or my third, or my fourth, or my fifth. It's one of those things, you kind of learn the tournament circuit, and then you start winning. Once you know what you're doing and how to kind of make it so you play the judges, you know what I mean? Like there's politics involved with a lot of the tournament circuits I involved in. So I was in the Stan Witt circuits. I was in the ICMAC circuits. So I was in IMAC, ICMAC. I was in compete for a brief bit, in the Pasadena tournament. I went to the San Diego Nationals. I'm trying to remember where else I've been, because it's realistically been the Southwest region that I've gone to, but they were international tournaments. So I've met people from all walks of life around the world. Hell, one of my good friends, I miss him to death. I haven't seen him in so long. Was a kid from Australia, and dude was nuts. Like, He wasn't a top competitor because of the judges, unfortunately. They kind of really screwed him. But he was a competent martial artist in both forms and the ring. So I wasn't one of the ones who had the option to pick and choose what I wanted to do. I had to do empty hand weapons, forms, weapon, empty hands, weapons, forms, techniques. I had to do both point and continuous fighting. Because I wasn't allowed to be, you know, cherry pick. Oh, I'm really good at this, but nothing else. Because my school was one of those, if you can't fight, you don't deserve to be a black belt kind of schools. And for the younger people, I get that. For the older ones, when you start seeing health issues, there's a problem. But, you know, only so much you can do when you're not so high on the totem pole and you're a pimple on the ass of Kenpo. So my time was marked with a lot of, honestly, just interesting times. I started making a name for myself, at least a small bit of one, because I used to have a fan club at the tournaments, which was fucking weird. From the time I was about 13 till I stopped competing when I was 18. 19, actually. No, I did one more tournament when I turned 19. And then COVID hit, and I never really went back, unfortunately. To competing, that is. So, it was fun. I have a few unfortunate blood matches that did take place during tournaments. I'm not sure if you know what the concept of a blood match is.
No.
So, unfortunately, warring schools do happen. People mouth off to the wrong instructor and, well, you kind of have to go and be their fighting dog, is how my teacher had handled it at the time. So, dude had mouthed off, the teachers couldn't figure it out between themselves, so students are sent in to do the dirty work. And I had two during my time. One was a dude who mouthed off about a grandmaster being illegitimate and, like, being a complete douchebag about it. And the other was a blood match that was racially fueled, because he was Armenian and I'm Greek. And he somehow found out, and I don't know what got his coffers, but that one was when I was 16, the Armenian one, and that was probably one of the hardest fights of my life. I wound up getting knocked out on my feet about 30 seconds in, and I don't remember what happened. But from the videos that I saw and from what I was told, I threw the dude into multiple rows of chairs, the judge's table, and into a judge. Somehow didn't get disqualified on either of us because they couldn't stop us at that point. So I don't remember much, but when I came to, apparently I'd won. I had a mild concussion, but apparently I'd won.
No.
So, I don't know, but, my tournament career was fairly long for youth, but it was fun, and I met a lot of cool people as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any thoughts about getting back into competing? Or?
Unfortunately, I am unable to until my spine heals. I have 4 torn discs in my neck and 4 torn discs in my lumbar spine, which have completely disqualified me from being able to do any of the competition I would like to do. Because my bread and butter was fighting. I really enjoyed it, and that's kind of where I enjoyed the language of the ring. Because when you're in the ring, it's you and the other person, and your fists do the talking. And you understand the intent, you understand what the person's there for, you understand why they're there purely through punching. And it's a really beautiful language if you know how to speak it.
Gotcha. Now, was your injuries martial arts related? Or
car accident.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
None of my injuries are martial arts related. I had a torn meniscus, and my spine is completely messed up from getting hit from behind.
Yeah.
I still kept training for a bit after the accident and getting my knee fixed at least, but unfortunately the spine did not like that.
No. Fortunately, I haven't had any major injuries. I think with a lot of people, they're not any injuries that I have sustained. They're not martial arts related.
It's the weirdest thing, too, because, like, you don't sustain injury. Even when you've, like, dislocated a shoulder on accident or something fat, pop it back in, get it taken care of. It's like, huh, that's not a lasting injury. Well, okay, to be fair, it is, but, like, it doesn't affect you as badly as, like, getting hit when you're not moving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A warmed-up body can take injury a little bit better than a cold body.
Mm. Yeah, it's always kind of, it's always funny to me that, you know, we're doing this combat art, and you know, you would think that there should be more injuries and stuff than there is, but you know martial arts gets this bad, oh, it's so violent and this and that and this, and it's like, you know, most people are controlled and you know, it's a better controlled environment. So that we, you know, we don't get hurt, because, you know, if you hurt your buddy, you can't train with them anymore. And like, who wants to show up to class just by themselves? You know, I do like the occasional private class, but I also want to, you know, train with my friends too. So if I beat them up, then, you know, that I can't do that. And then vice versa, you know, if I beat them up, then they have the right to beat me back up. So. You know, I don't like to get beat up.
Law of equal exchange. You hit them, they'll hit you back just as hard.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, yeah, it's a give and take, but you know, it's good pain. It's good pain, and unless you get the new guy that you know hits you with something, and it's like, the you know, they always say, you know, the most dangerous person in the studio is the new guy,
white belt. Yeah, the new guy,
not the white belt. You don't have to worry about them. It's the white belt you got to worry about. Although, you know, of course, not going to name any names, but did have well, I guess not a fight, but definitely have trained with some black belts that kind of. Let's kind of question that thing around your waist, but you know.
Oh, that is 100% a mood.
Everybody's journey is is different, but I got into some hot water, because we have this, you know, the great internet, and you can see all these kind of things on the internet, and there was a couple of videos going around of, I don't know if they were Kenpo people, but they were doing some questionable, their techniques that they were working on looked a little questionable. And you know, I had made some comments on the videos. You know, nothing bad. Well, I guess it's all perspective. In my perspective, I didn't say anything, you know, super bad. I was just like, you know, man, I hope these are not Kenpo people. It was really the main thing that I said. And you know, I got in a little hot water from my instructor, and yeah, he likes to tell me, especially when I'm testing, like, oh, like, you know, we should, you know, video this and put this up on the internet. And it's like, yeah, you know, I'm not the I'm not the best martial artist, you know, Kenpo guy in the world. I would probably be mortified to see me doing any kind of techniques online, you know, mainly because I really hate watching myself. You know, I may be doing it fine, but I just, oh, I can't, I, you know, that's why this You'll is an audio podcast, not a video podcast, because I just hate watching myself. But, my instructor's just like, you know, he likes to throw in every now and then, like, you know, oh yeah, you know, ooh, let's videotape that and put that on. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. I shouldn't have said anything. And, you know, yeah, that's everybody's journey. But, you know, there's a lot to learn from not only doing things right, but you learn, in my view, you learn a lot more from doing things wrong too. So, you have to get, you know, we have to get both sides of that. So, you know, just, I have fun with that, but, yeah, it's, there's a lot of different people out there, and a lot of different experiences and in the arts. And, we have to just kind of take them as we go, and just try and work on improving ourselves and not worry so much about everybody else. But
at the end of the day, that's all you really can do, especially when you're coming up the ranks, is until you have a really good understanding, at least from who your teacher is and everything, of like how your art's supposed to move, then you can start looking at other people and going, okay, let's look at the motion. And Kenpo is a lot about its explosiveness, its motion, its concepts and principles. On a fundamental level, not everyone does them the same. And it's unfortunate, because there are some really, really badass Kenpo practitioners. There are others, in my experience, in my vision, who I've seen, I'm like, look, I can see where you could extrapolate this being Kenpo, but this isn't Kenpo. And half the time it's because they can't move it anymore. That's understandable. The other half of the time is because they have a bad teacher. And a lot of the time you will see, you don't have bad students. You have a bad teacher who can't help them get to the point to where they can move it like a Kenpo guy. Mm-hmm. I'm using guy here, as both.
Gotcha. Yeah. There's definitely bad teachers, and there's also the in between of maybe they're not necessarily quote unquote bad. They just maybe don't know. Don't know the best way to we all learn differently, and you have to be able to adapt and change and learn how to work with different kinds of people and in different methods. You know, some people can just see something and know how to do it. Some people have to, read it out. Some people have to, people have to, feel is to believe. Some people have to feel it. And I think a good instructor can adjust to that and find, what works with each student to help them, be their best or get the most out of them. Or if nothing else, at least provide the inspiration for them to say, hey, why is this thing this way? Or, be able to ask the questions. So, in this woke entitled world that we are kind of now finding ourselves in, a lot of young people, and probably a lot of old people too. I'm not going to discriminate here, but there's a lot of people that are not interested in, thinking for themselves, or not interested in asking the questions, and they just kind of want everything to be given to them and handed to them. And, you gotta work for it and earn it. And, if you truly desire something, then you're going to try and seek it out and not just wait for somebody to give it to you.
It's interesting you bring that up, because that's kind of one of the things that I had to deal with a lot throughout my training at my school, is a little bit of an extreme version of that, to where even if I was seeking it out so I could get the answers that I wanted, and that, I had trained a hell of a long time to be able to get, I was stonewalled by my old teacher at a lot of opportunities, because he wasn't a great guy. I'm not going to lie, I will not name him on the podcast, because, I don't want to deal with that whole shit. Mm. But he wanted to have control over everything. And you can't have a decent martial arts career or training time if you have a teacher that, when you are asking the questions that they want you to ask, refuse to give you the answer. So it's kind of that you can be stifled on both ends. Yeah, sure, I can see it. There's a lot of guys nowadays that they don't want to spend the time, either because they don't know how to ask the questions yet, or because they think they're entitled to the questions. And those are two very different people. Because then you get the third person who knows to ask the questions, But then maybe they're afraid to because of a teacher like that, to where even if they ask, they're just going to be shot down because, oh, that's such a stupid question. You should know that already. Or, oh, that's too advanced for you, even though you're, you know, really close to black belt. And these are black belt level questions you're asking, so that, you know, you're in the right mindset. And it really does come down to your teacher at that point. Is the teacher that nurtures you is kind of the martial artist you will turn out to be. Is what I have found as kind of my experience in the martial arts with at least my upbringing and a few of my comrades' upbringings is it's really comes down to your teacher and the people you train with. Your headmaster is a lot of what you train with, and then also your immediate instructors throughout time really help shape your career. A student will always imprint on their teacher. And when you have a lot of teachers, you imprint on a lot of different styles. So if you have one teacher, you will almost always receive somewhat of a copy of that teacher, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So since we're kind of on the teacher thing, so have you done any teaching, or has that been part of your training? And was that kind of, were you always interested in being the instructor, or did that kind of come later on?
So I did have to do a lot of teaching to be able to even earn my brown belts and my black belt. When I was originally thrust into teaching, I was not a good teacher. Nobody is when they first start out, but I was especially like not a great one. Because I wanted to be a teacher because I imprinted on who my teacher was, and I wanted that power. I wanted to be able to, you know, hit people with a shinai, and, you know, all the bad reasons to be a teacher as a teenager. And so eventually that did get worked out, and I started realizing, wait, I can do a lot better of a teaching job if I actually work on these guys and help them see, okay, what's the problem here? Instead of being that, you know, harsh critic and then silent positive reinforcement, you know? Silence is the best reinforcement. It's like, no, it's not. Because people don't know, like, what was good about it. So I had to learn to change that over time because the style of teaching I was brought up in just doesn't work nowadays. People will not stand for it, for one, and for two, it's not beneficial anymore to the new generations of martial artists that are coming through. Even some of the older guys, they just won't put up with it. And it's really neat to see that a good portion of the abusive teachers that we know exist in the martial arts community are kind of getting forced out because of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I started teaching when I was 15. I was an assistant teacher from the time I was 13, so I started learning. And I kind of officially became more of a teacher when I hit first brown in the equivalent of the junior ranks. So I'm still a teacher. I still do, you know, train from time to time when I can, when I'm able to get the energy up and do it. But when everything happened, I lost kind of that esteem to be able to teach because I figured, oh, my only worth is being able to show them physically. And I had a lot of the teachers that I worked with over the years start coming to counsel me and go, no, you're a competent martial artist. You have a lot of value even sitting in that chair. If you're not able to do anything, have somebody else model for you, have them do what you want them to do, and learn this new style of teaching, and it's going to put you far. Because if you only have one style and that's all you know, you can't reach everybody. So you need to learn how to meld your teaching styles, like we were talking about. And so I had to quite literally sit in a chair and learn how to teach vocally and get people to do what I was looking for them to do. And it was hard. It was really hard, especially when working with people that have genetic disorders. My wife, who I love to death, she has Ehlers-Danlos, which is a connective tissue disorder. The way she could bend her body to be able to hit people were nuts. And making that work with Kempo while also working with it audibly was such a difficult challenge in my career of teaching. Like, I have a really short career compared to many, many martial artists. But I've gone through a few students who, like, were really interesting to teach. And when you're teaching, you are very much learning as much as the student is. Because one of the older Kenpo stories is how do you teach a man to smoke a cigarette? I don't know if you've heard that one. But
no, I'm not familiar with this one.
So as I understand it, Mr. Parker was one of the people who pioneered this story. And this is my understanding of it, of course. I don't know where the actual story lies or starts from, but Mr. Parker, when he told this, was, okay, you're going to teach a man like you're going to teach somebody how to smoke a cigarette. It's like, oh, well, that's simple. Just, you know, take it in your hand and light it up. Okay, so he takes a cigarette. All right. Lights it up in the middle of the cigarette. No, 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 that's not what you do. You need to take it in your hand. You need to have the end facing you, and then you light up the end. All right, lights up the end you're supposed to puff from. And it was a whole multitude of, okay, no, you need to take the filter end, put it in your mouth, take your lighter, light the other end where the tobacco is, and inhale as you are lighting it so you get a good light. And it's a really interesting concept of, oh, okay, something that might seem really trivial to us who know what we're doing. We can't expect that of somebody who's brand new to it, or maybe somebody who just doesn't think that way. So, and that was a story that would pass along my studio lots of times. Kind of that, oh, nope, you gotta teach him how to smoke a cigarette. And it was kind of one of those running things. There were a lot of running stories that, you know, people just kind of repeated in times of frustration going, oh yeah, no, that's, it's a cigarette. Gotta smoke it right. And it's kind of the thing is you really learn a lot by teaching. And I think that everyone who goes into the martial arts should have time on the mats attempting to teach or learning how to teach. Because if you limit yourself by only attempting to learn, you aren't going to learn some of the things that will come to you when you're teaching it and watching somebody else do it as you train them. Like Five Swords, for example, when we're working on that, half of my understanding from it comes from teaching it and working it on a body on somebody who's not going to go, like, kind of limp for you, or somebody who's not going to be as kind. And that's because that's when you really start getting that feedback you need. Is, oh, okay, let's tailor this to your body. And a lot of Kenpo, as it should be, and this is my opinion, of course, some guys will agree, some guys will disagree, but Kenpo is an art that is meant to be tailored to each person. It is not an end-all be-all art by any means. There are a lot of stuff that we really don't do in Kenpo that my training got from elsewhere, like our joint locks, throws, stuff like that came from jujitsu and swaijiao. Our kicks did not come from Kenpo, because Kenpo really doesn't kick well. We got our kicks from Korean arts because they were the ones who were good at it. So it's kind of an interesting mix of, okay, here's what we can learn, here's how we teach, and oh, that doesn't work for you. Okay, let's try this instead. And it's a brilliant time if you are willing to put in the time for it.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. You get so much greater understanding when you're teaching, and it's a different perspective, and it provides so much more than just showing up for class, and you just get a way better understanding and view, and you really have to break it down when you're teaching it to someone else. So yeah, I agree with that. So all right, so we are now hitting the lightning round here. So got a few little kind of questions here to throw at you as we head towards our close here. First right. One being, do you have a favorite technique?
Oh, I have a few, and because that's what each of them can do, but my favorite technique is easily Dance of Death.
Yeah, good one.
With extension. With the extension, because it's just so fun, especially when you learn the full application, so it's just, it's so good. Another one, Falcons of Force. A lot of people hate that technique so much, but I think it's brilliant. And then, I mean, come on, Five Swords is, it's a capstone technique. It is a master key technique. Mm-hmm. You can't hate on Five Swords, especially when you know how to just, bah, 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 just whip it properly with the extensions. Just, oh, so good.
Yeah, that was, that was one of the potential names of this podcast was the Five Swords podcast. But I was like, I don't know. Actually, so I put it out to the Kenpo groups, and my options were not well liked, so I had to go against the herd and you know pick something that I wanted to do. So
good luck getting Kenpo guys to agree on anything. Yeah,
exactly. And then the other thing that you'd mentioned that I thought about, so my original school, we didn't have extensions. The curriculum was essentially the Tracy's curriculum, so we didn't have,
so you extensions. Had the modifications to the system, A, B, C, D, yeah. E. Yeah.
And
I've trained with Mark, and he's honestly a really interesting guy. I've gotten to work with him over the years. Mm-hmm. I've learned a bit of the Tracy system, and I can see where the grassroots of the system come from for modern Kenpo.
Yeah.
It's definitely interesting, but I can see why Parker wound up changing his mind later down the line to make it more advanced, and advanced may not be the best word, but more academic, mm-hmm. I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because instead of having multiple variations for every technique, it's, okay, here's a base you can work off of. Let's teach you how to extrapolate it later on so you at least have a base of understanding, is what I've learned it to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the kind of the funny situation that I have with that, since we didn't have the extension, when I learned Dance of Death, and Dance of Death is the orange belt technique and at the first school that I learned it, and so I learned the whole thing there, and you know, it's like now at the school that I'm at, it's like, oh, like I want to do the whole thing.
Gotta, like, do the jig and everything.
You haven't got the extensions yet, but it's like I know it already. It's like, yeah. So that always comes pretty much every time I have to do that technique, that kind of comes up. So I can have a little laugh with that. So the next question, do you have a favorite form and or set?
Yes. I have one of each. So my favorite form is long four. It used to be long three, and then I learned long four and fell in love with long four as being the, like, black belt form. Like, that's, it's so beautiful when you can do it right, and I love it to death.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite set, however, may not be a favorite of everyone, but stance set.
Oh, interesting.
Stance set is because of how much it can build the legs properly,
mm-hmm.
and it really, when you are having to move through that many stances at the same point, it really shows you where your stances can be weak. And if you take the time to use it as a stance training set, holding the set stances for a minute at a time per stance. Form takes about like 20 to 25 minutes, not gonna lie. But you will have hefty legs at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. I like that. Okay. And then our last question there. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
That's a rough one because, like, I've gotten to train with some amazing people. I'm not going to lie. Ooh. Because, like, I know some people would say...
You can say them too.
I know that some people would say, oh, Ed Parker, because, like, he is the one who made it. And it's like, okay, cool. But, like, for me, from what I grew up hearing and everything, and from what I grew up watching, I would have loved to have been able to see Paul Mills firsthand. Being able to watch that motion, being able to watch the subtleties in the motion in person without the grainy footage that's what's left over would be brilliant. Because that's where my bread and butter is. That's my understanding of the explosiveness of Kenpo. That's my understanding of the timing of Kenpo. And, like, I've gotten to work with some amazing people who could emulate that, but the original would have been amazing to see and learn from.
Gotcha. I like it. I like it. Great answers there. So now is your time to go ahead and throw out anything that maybe we haven't talked about that maybe you wanted to mention, if you wanted to plug something, or if you just wanted to say whatever you want. This is your chance to put out there whatever you'd like, and then we'll close out for today.
Well, first, I want to thank you for having me on the podcast. It was honestly a really fun time. I wasn't expecting to get the message or anything, and it was pretty neat that, you know, I got the opportunity. If there's one thing I can say is, in your journey, when you were going through this, don't be discouraged by failure. As you know already, failure is going to happen again and again and again and again and again until you get that right feeling. And the first time you do a technique right, and I hope you've had this feeling already, you will have a weird, oh, that's how that's supposed to sink. Especially if we're going into, let's say, ooh, what's a good technique? Triggered salute. Triggered salute's a really good one that when you hit it right the first time for that rib shot before pop, it's so just satisfying to feel your uki sink.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get there, when you hit your targeting, like, targeting and timing are going to be your bread and butter to learn explosiveness. And, like, I'm hoping you have a really good teacher, and I haven't met them, so I can't speak for any of their stuff, nor will I, even based on, you know, hearsay. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a good teacher, you'll learn that over time, and you will be a damn good martial artist. And also, I do want to say, hey, Nick, hey, Dad, I got on a podcast before you. Ha!
I like that. I like that. Well, you know, you can can send him my link, and he can be on too. So I'll make sure yours gets posted before his. So.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thank you again so much for the opportunity. It's been really fun, and salute. I hope you make it to your black belt when you do. That's another thing is, don't be discouraged by how long it takes. You said you've already been doing this for 25 years for capoeira and longer for the arts. Don't be discouraged. It took me 18 years to get my black belt. For some people, it takes 6-7. For some people, it takes 2-3. But, you know, is there really a black belt at that point?
Yeah, that's a debate that we can save for
another series of shows. Yep.
But I thank you so much for taking the time to be on with me. You know, everybody has a story, and you know, I want to hear them all. You know, of course, you know, we want to hear, you know, the Lee Wedlakes and the you know, Chuck Sullivans and the Larry Tatums and.
I have Lee's book over here somewhere for the Kenpo forms.
Yeah, I've actually been reading the lessons with Ed Parker. You know, he updated it for 2024, and been reading that. I have to kick myself though a little bit with. So I did interview him or chat with him already, and before I had him on, I told him, okay, like, I'm reading your book. I'm sure I will finish it. You know, I'm almost done. I will finish it before we chat. And then, of course, you know, everything gets in the way, and
life
I've got
gets
like
in the
20
way.
Pages left. And you know, I got to chance to chat with him, and you know, I started off the episode. I was like, you know, I'm really really sorry. You know, I'm doing all the butt kissing right now, but you know, I'm sorry I didn't finish the book before we started. And but I'm gonna finish it. I'm been really really enjoying it, and so yeah, his episode is coming up soon as we're recording now. But
Nice. I can't wait to get him out there.
But yeah, I just thank you for being on, and can't wait for everyone to hear this, and I will be in touch when this is ready to go out. But yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.